We spend a lot of time on this show talking about national security whistleblowing and the fallout from that truth-telling. We've spoken about the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and the military. But what's it like to blow the whistle internationally? What is it like to take on the government of the United States, its allies in the United Nations, and the U.S. Congress all at the same time? We'll soon find out. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Scott Ritter is a name known to many around the world. A former U.S. military officer, Scott was the chief U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq in the period following the first Gulf War. He had already had extensive experience in the U.S. military, having been an officer working for U.S. Central Command General Norman Schwarzkopf. Scott's whistleblowing began then. In 1991, Schwarzkopf reported having destroyed 16 of Iraq's 20 Scud missile launchers. Those numbers couldn't be confirmed. And Scott said so, publicly. Later that year, Scott joined the United Nations and was assigned to UNSCOM, where he led the investigations into Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction, a position he held for almost the entire decade of the 1990s. Scott resigned from UNSCOM in 1998 after Iraq refused further cooperation with the United Nations and the Security Council refused to do anything about it. Scott gave testimony in a contentious Senate committee hearing in which then-Senator Joe Biden criticized him for conducting what he described as confrontation-based inspections in Iraq, even though that was the policy that successive U.S. administrations, both Democratic and Republican, had demanded. In the end, The New York Times' Matt Bay said that Scott, quote, was in fact vindicated about Iraq's lack of WMDs and that the aftermath of the Iraq War could be calamitous, unquote. He added that Scott was the most determined dissenter and the one with the most on-the-ground intelligence of the situation prior to the war. We're happy to have Scott Ritter with us. Scott, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Glad to have you. Let's begin at the beginning, as they say. You joined the U.S. military in 1980. After some years, you became an officer in the Marine Corps, and at the time that the Gulf War broke out in 1991, you were a captain working under General Norman Schwarzkopf. I remember him well from my time at the CIA. He was a legendary figure, and nobody, or practically nobody, spoke back to him. But you did. You said privately and later publicly that Schwarzkopf was simply not telling the truth when he told the American people and the country's leaders that the U.S. military had destroyed 16 of Iraq's 20 Scud launchers. You later told the media that the U.S. hadn't destroyed any of Iraq's Scud launchers. Was that your first brush with whistleblowing?
Well, I didn't whistleblow. I was doing my job. You know this, John. The job of an intelligence officer isn't to tell his or her boss what they want to hear. It's to put the facts on the table, and then the boss gets to make the decision. I was a junior captain. There's no doubt about it. I was a junior captain. But I was given a big responsibility, and one of those responsibilities was doing the final battle damage assessment of Scud engagements to make a determination whether or not an Iraqi Scud had been destroyed or not been destroyed. And this was big because at that time, Iraq was trying to draw Israel into the war. They were firing missiles that were not being interdicted. And Israel was saying, if the United States can't come up with a solution, we're going to enter the war. And that would have destroyed the coalition. That would have made it very difficult, if almost impossible, to defeat Saddam Hussein. So we needed to be projecting the perception of success. Mm-hmm. And so when the U.S. Air Force came in with videotape, showed a strike that the Air Force claimed destroyed Scuds, everybody was optimistic. But unfortunately, the battle damage assessment officer, me, was responsible for making the looked at it and said, those are oil tankers. They're not Scuds. I thought that was it. But then Schwarzkopf went on national TV and briefed it as if it was reality. Mm-hmm. The next morning, when I had to write the report, I wrote confirmed Scuds zero. The colonel that was between me and Schwarzkopf came in and said, you got to change that number. And I said, no, I'm not going to change that number. He said, when the general briefs it to the world, the number, I said, that doesn't make it fact. Fact is it's zero. You're asking me to falsify a document. I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. He went back, came back, said, you're fired. General Schwarzkopf just fired. You're done. Get out of here. So I did. But before I left, I handed a report off to the senior DIA lead, Defense Intelligence Agent liaison, who sent it back to General Admiral McConnell at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who took it to Colin Powell. And Colin Powell got in a phone call with Schwarzkopf, and Schwarzkopf said that that analyst is dumb. He's not as good as the others. He's wrong. Well, Schwarzkopf had the DIA do satellite or do a computer enhancement of the imagery. Is exactly what I said it was. They were fuel tankers, and I was given my job back. Wow. But they didn't change the number, because once they put that down there, they had to maintain the perception that we were killing Scuds. But I maintained throughout the entire war, we didn't kill a single Scud. And I don't just mean the Air Force. I mean the British SAS. I mean Delta Force. Everybody was out there hooking and jabbing with the Iraqis. We didn't kill a single Scud. That was a very contentious assessment, because medals were handed out for people mm-hmm. who were killing Scuds. Turned out I was 100% correct.
In late 1991, you moved to UNSCOM and became one of the chief weapons inspectors. You were the chief weapons inspector on 14 of the 30 inspections of Iraqi facilities. You were looking for evidence of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. I remember those days, Scott, as if they were yesterday. The West insisted that Iraq had WMD. The Iraqis insisted that they did not, but they still would not let you carry out your inspections unmolested. You then did something that angered the United States, although it helped the cause of the inspections. You sought the assistance of the British and Israeli intelligence services. The U.S. criticized you, and the Iraqis were enraged that you did it, but you stuck by your guns. What was it like handling all of these different competing interests? These aren't clothing companies or retail companies that you were reporting back to. These were the most important and powerful governments in the world and their intelligence services. What was that like?
Well, remember, when I started the job with the United Nations Special Commission, I was 30 years old.
Wow.
Now, I don't know what people think about 30-year-olds, but I will tell you that I was young. I had some experience under my belt, but not enough. And yet they threw me into a job where I had the weight of the world on my shoulders. And the weight of the world isn't just, you know, having responsibility for going in and implementing inspections. The United States government brought me, you know, I was brought in to create an intelligence organization. I was brought in by the United Nations. The United States government didn't want me there to do that job. And they actively conspired to have me removed from that position, but the United Nations stuck with me. One of the reasons why is that, as you know, intelligence drives operations. The person who controls the information controls the scope and scale of the operations. The last thing the United States wanted to do was have the CIA lose control of the pace of inspections, the direction of inspections, the nature of inspections, and have that taken over by the United Nations that would be calling its own shots. Mm-hmm. That was my job, was to empower the United Nations to call their own shots. So not only am I going into Iraq to try and find weapons that the Iraqis don't want us to find, and let's be clear, Iraq had significant weapons mass destruction program. You know, there's a difference between 1991 and 1998. There's 7 years
right.
in which inspection teams led by me and other inspectors went in there and disarmed Iraq. And when they didn't do it cooperatively, I don't want to tell you how many times I had guns put to my face and they threatened to decorate the wall behind me with my brains.
Wow.
This was difficult. Every inspection team I led into Iraq had built in a hostage rescue component, because we anticipated that because of the confrontational nature of our work, the Iraqis could take us hostage. And because we had people of sensitive backgrounds on the teams, the United States had pre-deployed and forward-deployed hostage rescue teams to come in and rescue us. This wasn't, you know, some sort of geeky scientific work. Mm-hmm. This is frontline stuff of a level of intensity that people can't even begin to imagine. And it's wearing on you, because every inspection was a battle, a campaign, a military type operation. And while I'm doing this war against the Iraqis, I'm fighting a war with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The United States didn't want me to do my job. You see, disarmament was not the objective. We didn't want Iraq disarmed.
Right.
We wanted to create the perception of a non-compliant Iraq, an uncooperative Iraq, which was easy to do when they weren't compliant and they were uncooperative. Mission accomplished. But because of the tenacity of the inspectors, you know, Hussein Kamal, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, defected in August of 1995.
That's right.
And when he was debriefed by the United Nations, he said, your inspections are having greater success than you know. You have made us panic, and we have gotten rid of weapons because we fear your inspections. Mm-hmm. So we were doing something good. We were accomplishing a mission, but that the disarmament is not what the United States wants. So the more we succeeded in Iraq, the more angry the United States came and attacked. And when I say attacked, I'm talking about charging me with espionage, sending the FBI on me. That's a death sentence penalty. Harassing my family, harassing my friends, everything. We're talking about a full-scale war between the United States government and me. And because they wouldn't cooperate with us, I had a job to do. Mm-hmm. And so I convinced my bosses to let me go, for instance, to England, where I was able to get the British government to provide us with a covert signals intelligence collection team that we deployed into Iraq to monitor the communications of the Iraqi government and the Iraqi security services to see if they're moving weapons of mass destruction as we're doing the inspection. We had a U-2 aircraft taking photographs. The U.S. Right. government wouldn't give us quality interpreters because they didn't want us to read too much of the images. So I got permission to go to Israel, where I sat down with the Israelis in their photo interpretation units with the U-2 film. They helped find targeting, and then they used that in access to their database, the Israeli database, to give us any information about potential hidden weapons of mass destruction. Now, some people say, gosh, that corrupted the inspectors. No, it didn't. It empowered us because it allowed us to go in and hunt down the last remaining vestiges of these weapons of mass destruction program, and it gave us the credibility to stand before the international community and say, we have exhausted every possible venue there is for information, and there's nothing left, and if we therefore aren't finding any weapons, we can make the claim that Iraq is disarmed. That made me the number one enemy to the United States of America, and that's why they were disrupting my inspection. So as I was at war on two fronts, against the Iraqis, against the United States, and a third front, because the more success I had with the British, the more success I had with the Israelis, the more the United States conspired to tear down that relationship, and they finally succeeded. They went into the British, whom I had built a multi-year relationship with, convinced them that I was somehow untrustworthy, I was a spy, they shouldn't share information. They went to the Israelis and made the same claim. And so these great relationships that were producing results terminated because the United States didn't want the weapons inspection mm-hmm. teams to succeed.
Scott, you were really legendary in the respect that you went nose to nose with some of the most infamous leaders in Saddam Hussein's regime. You didn't seem to fear them. And indeed, you never mentioned that you feared for your safety in Iraq. You were also quick to criticize the Clinton administration, including Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Going up against the Iraqis and having them cancel inspections is one thing, but being criticized publicly by the President of the United States and the Secretary of State, and later on, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is an entirely different thing, especially when some of your own leaders refuse to back you. To what do you attribute that resolve that you had? Whistleblowers are often criticized for their stubbornness, but what gave you that strength to stand up?
I was a Marine Corps officer.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
Yep.
I mean, there's no secret here. I went through officer candidate school. It's a screening process. You show that either you have what it takes or you don't. I went through 6 months of basic training in Quantico. You either show that you have it or you don't. I went to the Fleet Marine Force as a lieutenant, where it's either sink or swim. You either prove you have the medal to lead Marines in combat, or they ask you to the exit. Mm-hmm. I proved my capability. I worked in this former Soviet Union implementing the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Implementing the treaty, I served in the Gulf War. I went nose to nose with General Schwarzkopf. That's what you do. You say I wasn't afraid. I was scared to death. I knew what the risks were. I knew what we were getting ready to do. Mm-hmm. But when you lead people, you can't show fear. I was assembling teams of 50, 60, 70, sometimes 100 international experts from around the world, many of whom had very thin necks, thin arms, because they lived in an insular environment. These are people who were experts in chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles, but they weren't aggressive, confrontational people. And I was now going to lead them into Iraq, where we knew there would be men with guns pointing those guns at us, screaming at us, threatening to kill us. And I had to stand before them and say, don't be afraid. Just look at me. Mm-hmm. Look at me. If I'm standing there, and I'm not shrinking, you don't shrink. Mm-hmm. The Iraqis are like sharks with blood. If you fear, they hover around that fear, and they'll come at you. There can be no fear. And it was an act, because I was scared to death. But a leader doesn't show fear in front of the people they're leading. So I was a pretty good actor. But anybody who wants to sit here and think that I had nerves of steel and I had ice in my veins, I was quaking inside, because this was real. This was death. One mistake.
It was indeed.
One mistake and you're dead.
That's right. I'm going to ask you to stay with us, Scott. We're speaking with United Nations whistleblower Scott Ritter. There's a lot more to this conversation, so please stay with us through this short commercial break. We'll be right back.
Why isn't there any public debate on the conflict in Ukraine? Why have the elites embraced war and shunned negotiations? Where's the anti-war movement? And more importantly, how is all of this helping Ukraine and its people?
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with former United Nations weapons inspector and whistleblower Scott Ritter. Scott, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You became a noted commentator after you left the United Nations. You were a regular on Fox News for a period. You can be seen regularly on RT and heard on the Sputnik radio network. You're a successful author. What else are you doing these days? What kind of a transition did you make into media and commentary?
Well, I mean, I think my primary venue of employment is with an energy publication group, Energy Intelligence, where I provide geopolitical analysis relating to energy security and its products that are read by the major CEOs of every oil company in the world and anybody who's involved in the oil business. So I'm doing that. I also, again, I write for a variety of outlets. Over the past couple of years, I've written for the American Conservative, which is sort of a right-leaning entity. I've written for Truth Dig, which is sort of on the left, and I've written for people in the middle. There's no ideology here. Again, I'm an intelligence officer, a former intelligence officer, and my job isn't to try and promote some political agenda. My job is to put the fact-based analysis on the table in front of a discerning audience and enable them to empower themselves with knowledge and information to formulate their own opinions. If I'm trying to tell you what to think, I've failed. If I'm empowering you to learn to think on your own, then I'm succeeding. So that's what I've been trying to do.
Scott, a question that I frequently ask guests on the show is what advice they would give to people considering blowing the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. Your whistleblowing was a little different. Your whistleblowing was on what came down to phony international policies on the parts of the most powerful countries on the planet. The personal cost to you has been high, like it is with many whistleblowers. With that in mind, what advice would you give, and what would you have done differently in your own case?
That's one of the toughest questions that's out there, John. I paid a horrible price. Now, if it's just me paying the price, I can live with that. But families pay the price. My wife paid the price. Mm-hmm. My children paid the price. My friends paid the price. My parents paid the price. Anybody who was in my inner orbit paid a price. And I'm just going to be straight up honest with you and your audience. Knowing what I know today and the price that has been paid, the cost that has been borne by so many people who didn't deserve to have to bear this cost, would I have done the same thing? And I can't give you an honest answer. I mean, I believe what I did was the right thing, but the price paid, the cost incurred was horrific. And I honestly can't tell you that I would have done that. And so therefore, I'm the wrong person for people to come to and say, should I blow the whistle? I mean, if you want to have a textbook you know, session in morality, I would say, yes, of course, you have to tell the truth. You have to speak truth to power. If I want to talk to you as a human being, I would say, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to pay a price that is beyond imagination. You can't comprehend the price you're going to pay and the price your family's going to pay, the price your friends are going to pay. And here's the other thing about it. The government doesn't care. The people don't care. That's the biggest lesson I took away from this. Sure, there's a lot of people today that say, thank you very much for doing what you do. I spoke out to stop a war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. We didn't stop that war. Mm-hmm. I continue to speak out today to try and improve relations with Russia, but we're not improving relations with Russia. It's an uphill battle. It's, you know, it's like that Greek, that Greek god that has to push the rock up and only to have the rock
Sisyphus.
Come down. He has to start all over.
Sisyphus,
yeah.
Yes.
That's it. Mm-hmm. You're never going to get to the top.
Yeah.
You're never
that's
going
right.
to get to the top. So doing the right thing does not produce an outcome worthy of the sacrifice. But here's the thing. Here's the killer. Every morning I wake up and I look in the mirror, I'm damn proud of the man staring back. And when I look my wife in the eyes, I can see the pride in her eyes. When I look
that's
my
right.
daughters in the eyes, I can see the pride. And you can't put them. You can't put a price on that.
Yeah.
You can't put a price.
You're absolutely right. Scott, I say exactly the same thing. I say exactly the same thing. The price is high, higher than anybody can imagine before they actually blow the whistle. But with that said, I can sleep at night. My children respect
yep.
me. And I like to think that I've left a legacy for future generations, my grandchildren or great-grandchildren, who I likely will never know. At least they'll know that when push came to shove, I did the right thing. So you're right,
the
cost
right
is very high, but boy, is it worth it. I want to
so
ask you,
other,
oh yeah, please go right ahead.
Just one thing,
yeah.
and I apologize for that.
Not at all.
What we're doing, if we think what we're doing is going to expose the truth and that's going to be the outcome, we're wrong. We can expose the truth, mm-hmm. but they're going to come. Hopefully what we're doing is setting a standard, not for the government, the government
yeah.
has no standards.
That's right.
But for the American people.
That's right.
Who begin to demand of their government, and we get to the point where we don't need whistleblowers. That's mm-hmm. the key, where we don't need whistleblowers because the government is sufficiently transparent enough and the people have confidence in the decisions being made that they're being told the truth, so there doesn't have to be whistleblowers. The fact that there needs to be whistleblowers tells everybody right off the bat that the
There's
system
a problem.
Is fundamentally broken.
Exactly right. Scott, I have to ask you about the conflict in Ukraine and your position on it. You were an early supporter of Russia, but in a very reasoned way. I've seen interviews where you work to contextualize the conflict in the scope of modern history. But that hasn't stopped the Ukrainian government, for example, from adding you to a list of what they call Russian propagandists. Your Twitter account was briefly suspended. What has the fallout been for you? Has it been harder for you to work because of your position on Ukraine?
It's almost impossible for me to work.
Oh.
Every mainstream media, when I say mainstream, I used to write for some good American-based journals. I don't get to write for them anymore because of the stance I've taken. My primary employer won't let me write on Russian issues anymore because they feel that my name attached to anything that's a positive assessment on Russia is Russian propaganda. It's mm-hmm. the dumbest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But and when I try to speak out, venues are attacked. I've tried to have book signing venues, and they get called up by pro-Ukrainian elements to threaten violence, and no business wants to give host to something that's going to bring down their business. So it has had a horrifically detrimental impact on my ability to make an earning. And as you know, John, we do things because we believe in it. We do it for honor,
mm-hmm.
but none of that puts food on the table. None
right.
of that pays the mortgage. None of that puts a roof over the head or clothes on the back of your children. At the end of the day, we are providers for a family. That means we have to have gainful employment. And here I am trying to do the right thing for my country. Anybody who thinks I'm doing this because I'm in love with Russia and I'm doing this for Russia, you don't know me. It's just like I didn't speak out about Iraq because I loved Saddam Hussein and I loved Iraq. Saddam's an issue, but Iraqi people I have great respect for. I don't hate them, but I did it because I love America. because I believe that before we send American service members out to fight and die in a war, we have to make sure the cause that we're asking them to give their lives for mm-hmm. is worthy of the sacrifice. In Iraq, it wasn't. And now we have a situation in Ukraine where the same questions have to be asked. I'm asking the questions. They don't like the answers. But instead of trying to deal with this responsibly, they're trying to shut me up. And that's okay. You can shut me up. But remember we talked about the cost, John? Mm-hmm. My family pays the cost.
That's
right. You know, when my daughters want to go to graduate school and I can't provide the money to write mm-hmm. it up, so they have to take loans, that's a cost. When my wife hasn't been on a vacation in 20 years, that's a cost. And people can say, well, that's a little frivolous. Really? Dude, you tell your wife you can't go on vacation
right.
for 20 years.
And
see how frivolous and stuff.
That's yeah. right. Well, I would like to thank our guest, Scott Ritter, and thank you to our viewers for joining us. I'd like to leave you with the words of Polish-American poet and writer Czesław Miłosz, who said, quote, "In a room where people unanimously maintain a conspiracy of silence, one word of truth sounds like a pistol shot. Speak up, speak the truth, the world will be a better place for it." I'm John Kiriakou. Thank you for watching The Whistleblowers. Until next time.